it has resource management implications, and they're pretty varied: commercial, sport, subsistence, wildlife.
An Alaska Supreme Court decision that could affect fish and game bag limits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the White House Christmas tree makes its grand entrance from Alaska.
Last year when we brought it from Minnesota, it really looked a lot more like a Charlie Brown tree. I mean, just was kind of all twisted up, and this one looks beautiful.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Governor Bill Walker is once again shaking up the state's gas line team. Today, he replaced two of seven board members for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, or AGDC. That's the entity that represents the state in the massive Alaska LNG project to bring natural gas from the North Slope. The announcement comes less than 24 hours before the board is set to take two crucial votes. First, on whether to approve the deal to buy out TransCanada, and second, on whether to continue the project for another year. That vote is scheduled for 8:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. Walker has removed former Alaska Attorney General John Burns, the board's chairman. His seat will be filled by Luke Hopkins, who finished his two terms as mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough last month. Six of the seven members have been replaced since Walker took office. Walker spokesperson Katie Marquette says the governor wanted a municipal representative on the board. Before serving as mayor, Hopkins was a planning commission and borough assembly member in Fairbanks. Alaska is on track to be the first state in the nation to allow recreational use of cannabis at venues similar to a bar or a cafe. In its Friday meeting, the state's Marijuana Control Board adopted an amendment creating a permit option for on-site consumption. The measure opens the door for commercial marijuana retailers to set up areas where patrons can use marijuana products. Teresa Collins owns Anchorage Business Potluck Events, which won a victory with the board's ruling on the measure, as well as another amendment lifting a ban on marijuana clubs.
We're hoping to work with the legislator, the Marijuana Control Board, and try to make it so we have safe, responsible places for people to consume cannabis.
The board also removed caps on the potency of refined products like oils and concentrates, though it left limits in place for edible products. Taken together, pro-cannabis and industry advocates say the raft of amendments passing today are an accurate reflection of the public's will. In more than 500 pages of written comments over the rule drafting process, many complained of overly restrictive regulations coming from the state's regulatory body. Collins says many of the changes finalized by the board are closer to what she and other proponents of last year's ballot measure 2 had in mind when they supported a commercial cannabis market.
I am ecstatic, and it's my birthday.
The Marijuana Control Board regulations will now go to the Department of Law for review and then on to the Lieutenant Governor for final approval, barring any major actions by legislators during the upcoming session. Though the state has the power to set general rules, cities and towns can opt out of approving licenses, similar to current local option laws on alcohol. The U.S. Forest Service has released a new plan for managing timberlands on the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. It puts a timeline on the transition from young to old growth logging, and it attempts to make it easier to develop hydro projects. The draft environmental impact statement document reflects this year's unanimous recommendation by the 15-person Tongass Advisory Committee on transitioning to a harvest of younger, second growth trees on areas that have already been logged. Forest Supervisor Earl Stewart says the agency's analysis shows that transition is possible in 16 years.
And going to a young growth system is going to require both accuracy and precision in the product availability and the ability to go to areas that have been harvested in the past. That's certainly going to cause some concern from some parties as to what that represents in the meantime, but recognize that this is a draft environmental impact statement.
While the plan does not recommend new lands for permanent protection, it would reduce the acreage that could be logged. Environmental groups are happy to see lands around some southeast salmon streams would no longer be logged. Southeast Alaska Conservation Council Deputy Director Emily Ferry says there's both good and bad in the updated plan.
The unfortunate part is that the Forest Service missed a huge opportunity to put the controversy associated with clear-cutting old growth behind them.
Ferry says the plan does not transition out of old growth logging soon enough. For the timber industry, the young growth available wouldn't keep Southeast sawmills operating. Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham doesn't think the transition recommended by the Tongass Advisory Committee will work.
The only way to keep the sawmills operating is to continue harvesting old growth, and we don't want to be stuck with just one good sawmill. We want to have, you know, a number of mid-sized sawmills and a number of small mills.
The draft documents are available online. A 90-day public comment period starts today and ends February 22nd. The Forest Service plans to hold public meetings on the plan in southeast communities. A 74-foot tree cut from the Chugach National Forest near Seward nearly a month ago arrived at the U.S. Capitol today. It's the first time the Capitol Christmas tree has come from the 49th state, APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The Lutz spruce tree arrived on a flatbed resting on wooden cradles. The tree's 40-gallon hydration bladder and the trailer sidewalls were removed ahead of time for the tree's grand entrance at the base of Capitol Hill. Fairbanks and John Shank, a trucker for four decades, drove the whole 4,000-mile journey, other than the ocean part, from Anchorage to Tacoma.
Oh, the trip was awesome. The help along the way with the law enforcement from the Forest Service, they've been with me from day one. And without them clearing the lanes for me to make these turns, it would have been a real tough job.
The Linden transportation driver normally plies the Dalton Highway. He was chosen for this mission in part because of his long accident-free career. But Shank just happens to have a long white beard and, no kidding, red apple cheeks and twinkly eyes. Bruce Ward was part of the tree's cross-country entourage, and he says the good-natured Alaskan trucker was a big hit at the 15 events they held along the tree's route.
Couldn't get him to wear the Santa Claus hat, though, but he didn't need it.
Ward leads a nonprofit called Choose Outdoors that coordinates with the Forest Service to bring a tree to the Capitol from a different state each year. The organization raised $650,000 in corporate donations to transport the Alaska tree. Ward says it's a great specimen, nice and full.
Last year when we brought it from Minnesota, it really looked a lot more like a Charlie Brown tree. I mean, just it was kind of all twisted up, but this one looks beautiful by comparison.
Ward says there were a million special moments on the tree's journey, starting when they were in the Chugach to fell it. This was after a big surge, after the superintendent of the U.S. Capitol grounds had already flown to Alaska and selected it. Ward says on the big day, they asked Kenaitse Elder John Ross to bless the harvest.
An eagle actually circled the tree before it was cut. And he said afterwards, he said, he asked the Great Spirit to let him know if it was okay to cut this tree. And the message he got was, if the eagle lands on the tree, you're not to cut it. And so I'm kind of praying that he doesn't land on the tree, right? Because we got to a lot.
The tree will be lit at a ceremony on December 2nd by Soldotna fifth grader Anna DeVold, with help from the Speaker of the House. At the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual fish washes up in southeast.
I drove past it at about 45 miles an hour and knew exactly what it was.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news about Alaska businesses and industries for over 30 years. News, information, and subscriptions are available online at akbizmag.com. and by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Supreme Court has upheld a lower court ruling dismissing charges against three Southeast subsistence fishermen. In an opinion issued today, the Alaska Supreme Court found because the regulation used to cite the men was not created according to law, it was unenforceable. The decision could have a major impact on Department of Fish and Game bag limits across the state. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield reports.
Estrada versus the state of Alaska concerned three men accused of taking more fish than their permits allowed. A fourth man who didn't have a permit was also cited but pled out. Rocky Estrada, Scott Hunter, Stanley Johnson, and former Angoon Senator Albert Kukesh were arrested in July 2009 for harvesting 148 fish. Their permits only allowed for 15 sockeye salmon per family.
I wasn't even fishing that day. My brother was fishing. But when I saw them, Fish and Game came in and started giving them a citation, I was looking for something that we could challenge the particular bag limit.
That's Kukesh. He served in both bodies of the Alaska legislature for a total of 16 years. At the time of the citations, he was representing Senate District C, which included a number of southeast villages.
So when I saw them giving my brother the citation, I went over and I said, here's my permit. I want to get a citation too.
The charges were dismissed by a judge at first, but the state appealed. The fishermen saw the citations as unfair. Kukesh said no one in Angoon recalled the Department of Fish and Game consulting with locals informally, which the department claims it did, let alone officially. If they had, Kukesh says the resulting regulation that set the bag limit may have been more agreeable to locals.
Maybe we can agree on the 15 fish, but we have to define family. We have to define how do you get to 15 fish? Because less than a mile away from where we got sighted, commercial fishermen were fishing, catching all the fish they wanted.
In 2013, the Alaska Court of Appeals reinstated the charges. Their reasoning was that because the legislature knew the Board of Fisheries was enacting this kind of regulation, their inaction to amend or clarify the board's power indicated that they believed the board acted within its authority. That's a conclusion the Supreme Court found to be beside the point. For the justices, the question wasn't about the authority to create regulations. It was about whether those regulations were established according to the Administrative Procedures Act, a law that defines the process for creating a regulation. How extensively this decision will affect bag limits across the state is still unknown.
This may not be just for the bag limit in Angoon. There's bag limits for everything in the state. For moose, for deer, for everything. And we don't think that this is going to be such a small Angoon case. It's going to be an Alaska case.
That's really the question we're wrestling with, too. We're going to pull together our directors on Monday morning and with the Department of Law and just kind of walk through it.
Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks says the department is still figuring out what the decision means.
It has resource management implications, and they're pretty varied, so we have to spend some time. And it's both commercial sport, subsistence, wildlife. We've got to spend some time and figure it out.
Kukesh says this is just one of many issues surrounding subsistence management in the state that will be challenged over the years. He says this case was about making the department consult with those in rural Alaska.
So we intended to fight this. We intended to challenge it, and we did. And today, after all those years and all of that heartache and all that stress, we finally got a result that we think was right.
A spokeswoman for the governor said the Walker administration is still reviewing the case. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
A four-legged thief is blamed for the disappearance of a warm water fish carcass that was discovered in Alaska waters, but at least there's proof in the form of pictures. KTOO's Matt Miller has more.
It was interesting to find it.
Gary Johnson, a fish buyer for Yakutat Seafood, says he and some friends were driving along the beach looking for glass balls and beachcombing during their day off September 7th. They spotted the 5-pound skipjack tuna as they headed towards Seal River, a little over 10 miles west of the Siyu River and over 100 miles northwest of Yakutat.
I drove past it at about 45 miles an hour and knew exactly what it was. When I seen it, so I turned around and another friend of mine drove up. We picked it up and it was rigor mortis and still bleeding from the gills. So we thought, well, that was weird. It must have just died.
Johnson says they were curious about how it may have died and wondered if the recent trend of warmer ocean temperatures was a contributing factor. He says they took the tuna back to their fish camp at the Sayou River fish buying station, but someone else, or rather something else, had other ideas.
Eventually, we were going to eat it, and then a bear came and got to our cooler, and he had some fresh tuna.
Yeah, strangely enough, this is the second one since I've been up there on the river.
Nicole Zeiser, Assistant Area Management Biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Yakutat, took a few pictures of Johnson's tuna. She also has pictures of a much larger yellowfin tuna that was found 2 years ago, closer to the mouth of the Sayou River. Zeiser says she didn't see any hook marks in the mouth.
I mean, it's strange enough that they're that far north, but I have no clue, but it could guess or theory would be that maybe they're getting hooked up into the, you know, the trolling lines and then, you know, breaking off and then dying, washing ashore or something.
Zeiser says the yellowfin found by Caitlin Graber may have weighed 80 pounds.
It was a nice fish for sure.
Zeiser recalls that another skipjack tuna was also found nearby in 1981, the northernmost ever spotted at the time. It's unclear whether a developing El Nino in the equatorial Pacific is partially responsible for this year's skipjack tuna. Scientists are also monitoring another warm water anomaly, nicknamed the blob, that has persisted in the Northeast Pacific for over a year. There have been reports this year of pilot whales returning to California waters, OPA off Oregon, and prickly fanfish and slender snipefish in Oregon and Washington waters. The CBC is reporting that the blob could be responsible for recent sightings of triggerfish, butterfish, tope sharks, sunfish, and luvar off the coast of British Columbia. And sunfish have also been spotted in Alaska waters. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The Alaska Alcoholic Beverage Control Board hired a new investigator in early October. He's the first UPIC investigator in 15 years and maybe the first ever. KYUK's Lakeed Rashavis has the story.
I think there's a possibility that James might be our first UPIC investigator ever.
That's Cynthia Franklin, director of the ABC and Marijuana Control Board. And there's just one reason why she can't say that definitively.
Because we don't keep records like that, I can't, you know, confirm for sure.
The board oversees the state's alcohol and marijuana regulations and licensing. The board doesn't require quotas for hiring certain ethnic groups, but Franklin says diverse representation is important.
The more diverse the staff is and the more, you know, the more it resembles the community, the better.
Franklin says with Holscher's background as a former village public safety officer in Hooper Bay, he was a competitive applicant with valuable field experience.
Much of his understanding of interacting with a community as an enforcement officer is enhanced by his heritage.
Holscher agrees. Holscher says with a community that size, you have to go about things with some consideration. It's a philosophy he's applying to this new job as well.
I guess the same type of approach in this job as I took with Hooper Bay, because when you live in such a small community, you have to treat the people with absolute respect.
He says he tries to remember that kindness when dealing with license holders who may have had a negative experience with investigators in the past. As an investigator, he enforces alcohol and marijuana laws and makes sure license holders are following the rules.
They immediately get a little bit of anxiety and get a little nervous because they have an investigator going over and making sure that they're following rules.
In one instance, a woman became really upset, but
I explained to them what our role is, and I told them if they follow the rules that they agreed to follow, then there's really never a reason for them to be fearful of what enforcement does or what their job is.
Before coming to Anchorage, Holscher lived in Hooper Bay, where he made his way up from VPSO to first sergeant to police chief. He also worked as an instructor and training officer. In Bethel, I'm Lakeedra Chavis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Celebrate National Philanthropy Day in Alaska and honor outstanding philanthropist Diane Moxness, whose dedication of time, expertise, and donations make Alaska a better place to live, work, and raise Alaskan families. Join the celebration on Friday, November 20th at the Denina Center. Visit afpalaska.net. This message sponsored by Alaska Public Media and AFP Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Angela Denning. This week on AK, new fuel for a rural school. Large-scale logging on the Yukon River began about 100 years ago when steamships burned a cord of wood per hour to power their engines. Village residents clear-cut wide swaths of forest along the river, but the logging tapered off when ships switched to diesel. These days, villages like Galena are once again looking to the forest for an energy supply. As KIYU's Tim Bedoni found out, the new generation of loggers is thinking more about sustainability in how and why they harvest trees from around their communities.
The first sizable timber harvest in decades is now underway just west of Galena in low-lying cottonwood-dominated forest. It's a patchwork of spindly, tangled undergrowth and scattered pockets of mature cottonwood trees. Bubba Aloysius is at the controls of a danglehead processor, plucking one tree at a time from one of these pockets. It's only his second day on the job, but he already talks like an old pro.
You got your button controls, which control the implement itself. There's grapple arms, the wheel, the measurement, the saw, the way it turns.
It's a far cry from the two-person whip saws that were the tool of choice in the last logging boom 100 years ago. The business end of this rig is a sort of Swiss Army knife of logging tools, a chainsaw, grappling arms, and ferocious-looking wheels with sharp teeth that can strip bark and snap off branches. Aloysius maneuvers the controls to grab a tree and then cuts it down in just a few seconds. Aloysius has operated all kinds of heavy equipment on construction projects and oil field work, but feels like this job is different.
It's something that's got to be done around here. You know, it's good for the future of Galena, so I wanted to be the man to do it.
The harvested wood is part of a plan to bring long-term economic stability to Galena by switching the former Air Force base from diesel heat to wood. The base is home to the Galena Interior Learning Academy, a boarding school, and the major employer in town. A new group called Sustainable Energy for Galena, Alaska is in charge of supplying the wood, but without any experience with industrial logging, the group had to bring in some experts like Sean Champagne, who's involved with the biomass energy project in Tok. Champagne says a big part of his job is to teach experienced equipment operators to become responsible foresters.
Your job changes every day, and you feel like you're doing a good job. I mean, you feel like you're helping Mother Nature. You know, in the old times, fires redid everything. And now that we're stopping the fires, the forests are dying from being too old. So a good forester will tell you that logging's beneficial to the woods if you do it right.
Tim Kalki is trying to make sure the timber harvest is done right. He manages the logging operation and wants to make sure that his crew is picking the right trees that will fit nicely in the wood chipper later on, but also choosing to leave some trees behind as habitat for birds and other animals. Kalki is also a high school teacher. He recently brought his natural resource management students out to the harvest site for a lesson on how logging can be sustainable.
I told them the other day they were the last students to stand in that patch of trees, and they all looked at me with kind of a horrified look because it was really beautiful and it was nice. And I said, for about 45 years, they made that connection that, wait a minute, you know, we're using this local resource as a fuel, and it's renewable, it's going to come back if we do it right, you know.
Students in the school's vocational program may also get some hands-on experience with turning local timber into finished products. Cottonwood is relatively soft and doesn't splinter, making it a good choice for things like picnic tables and railings. Back at the rig, Aloysius spins the wheels of the processor and 30 feet of tree shoots out the other side. Then the chainsaw quickly slices through the tree, and another stick of cottonwood joins the growing pile. Aloysius and his crewmates are trying to finish the timber harvest before Christmas. Not that cold weather would bother him in the cab of the danglehead processor, which features a very nice heater, a comfortable seat, cup holders, and a radio. Even more stuff that loggers didn't have 100 years ago. In Galena, I'm Tim Bedoni.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week on AK, we're talking with Athabascan ivory carver Leonard Savage about how he got his start.
You know, we'd go to the fish camp every summer. And, you know, you get lots of time on your hands. And so I, you know, found driftwood on the riverbank. And I borrowed my dad's knife and I carved little airplanes and, you know, propellers and stuff like that. And I remember once I had found some charcoal from the fire, and I went and drew pictures all over our smokehouse. I couldn't stop. I got stuff all over the walls in our house. When I was like around 15 or 16, I started doing pen and ink drawings, and I would go and reproduce them and put them in little frames and walk around town and into businesses and sell them. And then I saw an ad in the newspaper for somebody to carve whalebone. There was a whalebone carving shop here in town. They'd carve animals, and so I went over and tried it out, and it turned out to be, I could carve too. So yeah, I worked at a car wash for a little while, and I cleaned people's houses. But other than that, I don't think I worked more than 2 weeks for somebody else in my whole life. I think every ivory shop in Alaska has my stuff. I got customers in Iceland, Greenland, way over in Ireland, just about everywhere. I like doing it. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's work most of the time.
Leonard Savage splits his time between Wasilla and Kentucky. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Tim Bodoni, Ann Hillman and Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jennifer Canfield and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Lakita Chavis in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.